Welcome. My name is Jeff. I'm a compulsive overeater. And if we could start with a serenity prayer, I'm sure a lot of people would like to say that right now. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I will not mind be done. Thank you all for coming. We appreciate your being here. We don't have any real agenda to begin with, except to introduce our speaker. His name is Harlan. He's from Phoenix. He has a tremendous share, and he will be sharing for the next half hour, so make yourselves comfortable. If you could please help me in welcoming Harlan. Or maybe not. Where'd he go? He was just here. He took a centerpiece and is now going to his car. Well, Harlan will be here in a moment. You can talk amongst yourselves until then. And I'll just step away. And
step off.
How terrible. He was here. There he is, everybody. Here he is. Welcome, Harlan. Hi, I'm Harlan. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm so glad to be here. Before I say anything, I just want to thank the committee, Jeff and Sherry, and I know there's a million people I'm not mentioning from the entertainment last night. All the people whose work puts this together, what a miracle. What a miracle. My God. What a miracle. I definitely come by this illness very naturally. My mother was not aware that she was pregnant at all. My mother had a lot of mental and emotional problems. And on the morning that I was born, she called the hospital and complained about these pains that seemed to be getting worse. And they said, it sounds like a kidney stone to me. And they said, but you better get down here. And I was a kidney stone, and there I was. My father was 54 years old when I was born. My father walked out of Europe at a time when the world had gone crazy. And everything and everyone that he had ever known was annihilated and obliterated off the face of the earth. He did not speak a word of English. He was cast upon shores of a country he never aspired to come to and never expected to see. And he made a life as best he could. And they screamed and yelled at one another, and I'm absolutely positive that the very first sounds I ever heard in my life were them screaming and yelling at one another. And about the time I was 3-4 years old, I became my mother's husband and my father's wife, not in the sexual sense, but in a very real sense, because my mother would tell me every day, I hate your father, the only reason I live here is because of you. And my father would come home and tell me, I hate your mother, the only reason I live here is because of you. And I'm 3 and 4 years old, and all I really wanted to know was Huckleberry Hound going to get away from powerful Pierre, or was Yogi Bear going to get away with the picnic basket? And I didn't really know what was going on. But there was a tremendous, tremendous amount of upheaval in that home all the time. There was one time, there was one moment in the days where there would be all quiet on the Western Front. When there was massive, and I mean massive quantities of food on the table, there seemed, the guns of Navarone seemed to still very temporarily, and meals in our home were just breaks from constant grazing and snacking. There was always food, And I remember that when I was a little kid, people would scream and yell at my mother and father about how fat I was. And then when I got to be about 5 or 6 years old, they just started screaming directly at me. And there were things that they would tell me, there were things that they would scream at me that I didn't know what to do. And you know, the first victim of compulsive behavior is the truth. The first thing to go is the truth. And in Bill's story, in the big book, on the second page of Bill's story, he starts to lie to Lois about how men of genius constructed their greatest thinking when drunk. He's lying because he doesn't know the answer to the basic question, nor did I. Why are you eating that? Why aren't you on a diet? And I was told things as a kid, like, if you loved your mother, you wouldn't eat that way. If you loved your dad, you wouldn't eat that way. If you, you know, don't eat so much, you'll feel better. And all these various things, and I was very confused. And from the time I was a little kid, I could not understand this basic idea in my head. All I wanted to be was thin. All I wanted to do was eat. I did not have an understanding how these other kids, how these other people seemed so effortlessly to fend off that idea of eating food. They did not seem to succumb to this overpowering desire to eat food like I did, nor were they focused on food all the time like I definitely was. And so I thought myself very weak, and I thought myself very stupid, and I thought myself very ill-equipped to live in the world. And when I was about 8 years old, I was in third grade, and I remember my mother taking me to a doctor on Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, and I was 8 years old at this time, and I am now on 1,500 milligrams per day of amphetamine. I am in the third grade. I can feel the temples of my head bobbing in and out, and I can feel every heartbeat. And I get accused of this now, but I would say the same thing 150 times in a row. And I'm sitting in here wondering, why are you saying that again? Why are you saying that again? And I can't seem to stop. I can't. It's like something that's beyond my control. And, you know, you sleep like, you know, 10 minutes a month, you know. But, and now, when the pills wore off, I ate Illinois and most of Wisconsin, I'll tell you. You know, I don't know if anybody here is from Chicago, but you're really not, okay. Yeah, really, I mean, you're not from Chicago if you haven't used your air conditioner and your heater on the same day kind of thing. They won't get that. They don't really know. They don't get that, you know. Okay. And when I was about 9, and I lost weight, but I started getting, I'm an eater. I'm not a fighter. I'm getting in fist fights at school because I'm on these drugs and, like, I'm nuts, but I lost weight, you know, and it was wild. Now, when I was about 9 years old, some of the information, I was 9 years old in 1964, I was born in 54, I was 9 years old. Some of the information on these amphetamines as a weight loss tool started coming out. Some of the magazines, some of the newspapers started publishing these articles about these amphetamines. So all they basically did was switch me from a pink pill, 1,500 milligrams per day, to a blue pill, 250 milligrams, but four times a day instead of three. So basically we were just switching seats on the Titanic there a bit. And now it's the same exact result. I'm not eating, but I'm absolutely crazier than you can imagine. I'm absolutely nuts. And when I stopped taking the pills, what was explained to me was a lie also. Now that you've lost some weight, don't you feel better? Now you won't eat so much. Well, let me tell you something that I didn't have an explanation for then. But when I don't eat so much and I'm not in recovery, I really do feel better. I feel anger better. I feel fear better. I feel jealousy better. Crushes on girls better. I feel lots of things better. And the one thing that I knew to put out that 5-alarm fire, I didn't know it, but I felt it, was to eat more food. Because my mind was already locked in on the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by eating the food. And all of my life, from the time I was a child in kindergarten, I have spent fighting a battle that I did not know I would never win. I would get the thought that I want to eat Butterfinger bars. I want to eat pizza. I want to eat French fries, whatever that might be. If you haven't heard me before and I mention specific foods and anybody faints, give them room just to get, and we'll take care of you. And I did not understand that I cannot beat that thought no matter how hard I try. And I spent decades of my life showing up for a nuclear war with a stick, trying to fend off the thought that says, I'm not going to eat that. I'm not going to eat that. All right, give me one. Okay. I never ate one cookie unless it was the last cookie. And so as I started living my life, I got fatter and fatter and fatter. And I could not understand why this thinness, why looking like the other kids. And you know how you hear, like in the 60s, everybody wanted to march to the tune of their own drummer? Baloney. I wanted to look just like everybody else. I wanted to wear Levi's, which is why I'm wearing jeans today. I wanted to wear blue jeans, and blue jeans don't come in ox sizes. And there was no big and tall stores when I was a kid. You had to wear stuff. If it fit and my dad could afford it, it went on me. I used to have to wear clothes that went out of style before World War II broke out. You know, if we could find me clothes and they fit, that was it. That was the end of the discussion. And the Madras shirts and all, I wanted to look like the other kids, especially when I started getting into my teenage years and you start having those feelings. And, you know, I was the fat kid and all that. And I never went to homecoming. I never went to the dance. I never went to the prom. I never did any of those things. And this disease started its acceleration of a death grip on me. The older I got, the more and more fatal the disease became. And more it started really removing me from anything that were my dreams or my aspirations. And I really was looking at life from a very large chasm. And I was over here with my food, and I could sort of see you, and I could sort of hear you laughing and having fun, and you were beckoning to me to come to you. You were kind of beckoning me over, thinking, why don't you come and join us? But I just couldn't breach the cavern because I was stuck there with my food. And I felt very suicidal. And I didn't understand, as I went into my teenage years, what was wrong? Why couldn't I get a handle on this? And I did the very same things that all of us did. And Bill writes about it in the big book. Bill talks about periods of sobriety. And what was Bill doing? It starts with a D, it ends with a T. He was going on a diet, wasn't he? He was trying to control his consumption of alcohol on his unaided willpower. And that is exactly what I started doing. And for periods of time, I could be successful. It says, fear sobered me for a bit. But then came the insidious day when I drank again. Fear often sobered me for a bit, and I would eat again. I did everything I could. I was a member of TOPS. Do you guys know from TOPS now? TOPS. I was a Weight Watchers king. I was paraded down at the Pitt Congress Hotel in downtown Chicago. I had lost like 120 pounds. You know, and I was always on the bonus plan. Lose 80, gain 180. Lose 70, gain 140. I was always the bonus plan. I always talked about, well, if I get back to where I was, horse hockey. I never got back to where I was. I always would start here, lose weight, and then go way past where I was. And I was a Topps king. Lose weight with AIDS. Remember those little candies? Remember those? Lose weight with AIDS. And was it Metrical or whatever the heck it was? And Trim Slim and the milkshakes. I used to drink the shakes and eat candy. What the heck? Hey, if you're going to give me chocolate and tell me it's going to help me lose weight, baby, I'm in. Okay, so, and I did not have a clue that this was a battle I could not win. And as I got into my teenage years and as I got into different things, the world, my removal from the world became worse and worse. My friends were going off to college, and I went to college too, but my mom was dying and my dad was dying, and I had to stay in Chicago. My grades were not good. I was never comfortable in my skin. I was never comfortable in the desk. I was never comfortable. I was just waiting to eat. And I tested well, but I did not do good in school. And they were going away to campus schools, and I was so jealous. And I had to go to a commuter school. And when I was a junior in college, my mother finally got her wish. And my mother's greatest wish in life was to become an invalid and die. And she did when I was 22. And my dad died when I was 24 years of age. And when I was 24 years of age, I was alone in the world. I was broke. And I had nobody to turn to. I don't have family. I don't have cousins. I don't have aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters. I don't have any of that stuff. Grandparents, never had any of that stuff. But I have wonderful friends. And I have wonderful friends who love me very much. And when I started leaning on them just a bit too much, it became a problem. But when I was in my 20s, I was 335 pounds as a senior in high school. I was really, really nutso. You know, as if being 335 wasn't nuts enough. Not my food habit in the 1970s, not my cocaine habit, not my heroin habit, not my gambling habit. My food habit in the 1970s is about $150 per day. I'm eating every waking moment of my life. I am just absolutely off the wall, and I haven't got a clue as to how to live in this world. And I looked around, and as Bill contemplated suicide in his story, I contemplated it too. I did not know what prenatal felony I had committed, but I knew I was unfit to live in this world. And I did not put a gun to my head, but what I did was I had decided that it was going to be death by Butterfinger. And I was just going to keep eating, and whoever didn't like it could kiss my rear end or one of my rear ends. I had about five of them. And at this point, I am absolutely off the wall. My thighs were in different zip codes. I was absolutely off the charts. The contact dermatitis had opened up my skin, and that's a pain that I wouldn't wish on Hitler. Well, Hitler maybe, but not anyone else. I cannot lay flat and breathe in a bed, and I broke furniture constantly. I could not sleep in a bed because I could not lay flat and breathe. I had to sleep sitting upright in a broken chair. The edema in my lower legs, the swelling in my lower extremities was so profuse, so profound, that dime and penny size ulcers were in my legs and the pus would run out. I was a mess. I smelled like a zoo. I couldn't get in a car. I couldn't get out of a car. When I came to anyone's house, they always had a very special chair that they had been saving for me, or a special place that they wanted me to sit that they had been saving just for me. I became very agoraphobic. I was afraid. I didn't answer the phone, and it became disconnected. I'm writing tens of thousands of dollars worth of bad checks to anyone stupid enough to take them. I lied when the truth would have served me better. I hadn't paid my income tax for years. I was living life one step ahead of the landlord, one step ahead of the wolf at the door, and there was only one constant in my life. I woke up with a resolve not to eat, and very soon after that, I would be eating and eating and eating and eating, and the tears would come down my face, and my food got very salty because I would sit there, it would be like a Friday night, and my friends would be out with girls and doing the things that boys in their 20s do, and I'm sitting there, and I have food in the house, and I am swearing to God, no, not this time, no, don't let me eat it. And as that food would pump through me, and as I would eat it more and more, Bill pounded on the bar wondering how this happened, but I might as well get good and drunk this time, and I did. The food would become gone, and I didn't even know why. And the tears would just come up from the toes. And I was scared, and I was hurting. I was too scared to live and too scared to die. And so mercifully, not long after my father died in 1978, in February of 1979, two wonderful friends pushed their way past the filth in my home, the pizza boxes and the garbage in my home. And they led me to a meeting in Skokie, Illinois, at the Orchard Mental Health Center. God likes to laugh too. The Orchard Mental Health Center, and I attended my first of many meetings of Overeaters Anonymous. I did not want to be there. I ate my way to the meeting. I prayed for a Russian airstrike during the meeting, and I would eat my way home. But I got the idea that as long as I was going to these meetings, that it kept my friends off my back and they would continue to help me. By that I mean money. By that I mean leaving me alone, not nag me. As long as I was doing something about it, if you're listening on tape, I'm making air quotes. As long as I was doing something about it, it kind of fended them off just a bit. And little by little, in my first of three trips to OA, I started hearing some things that I had never heard before. I came into Overeaters Anonymous in February of 1979, and I saw a room that looked very much like the room that I see here today. I was 300-400 pounds fatter than anybody in that room and 20-25 years younger. And I didn't have the thought that I'm not a compulsive overeater. I wondered if you were. And little by little, I started hearing some things. It was a Thursday night at Swedish Covenant, a lady by the name of Della F., Roman Catholic housewife, with then two little kids, 3 and 5, speaking at Swedish Covenant Hospital. What did I have in common with Della? Nothing. Nothing. But she talked about food like I thought about food, and she reacted to food like I reacted to food, and I believed that those thoughts and actions were secret unto me. And a bridge started going over the chasm. First it was a rope, then it was a fence, then it was asphalt, and I could pass. But I did graduate OA a couple of more times before some things had to happen. The first one being is I had to be hospitalized at 513 pounds with ulcers running in my legs, and you wouldn't believe what I looked like at 513 pounds, the mess that I was. The absolute mess that I was at that time. Now, I'm limited in time, so I'm going to skip ahead here to something that's very important to me. I did not understand that there is a huge, profound difference between dieting with group support and being in recovery. I did not understand until I came into OA the third time that I had to have a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps as it is in here. The thesis line of the big book is on page 45 in the middle. It says, the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. My problem is not that I'm thinking about eating candy. My problem is not that I'm thinking about eating potato chips. And I didn't know why I needed God, because the God of my childhood would not have kept me out of the food for 7 seconds. They didn't talk about God at Tops. They didn't talk about God at Weight Watchers. What the hell is this God stuff? I didn't know why I needed God. I didn't get it. The reason that I need God and the reason that I need this program is because of causes and conditions that were forcing that thought out of my head that says, I want Raisinets when I go to the movies. I would eat the Raisinets. I would trigger the physical allergy. I would pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging again with a firm resolution not to eat that way again, and I would repeat that cycle over and over and over again. The mind telling me it's okay, the body ensuring that it's not. The more I ate, the more I want. The more I want, the more I ate, and it is endless. In a normal temperate eater, that does not occur. I need God, because in front of the thought that says, I don't even care if the projector's broken, just get me to the theater, I need the Raisinets. In front of that thought is a triggering of selfishness, self-seeking, dishonesty, anger, fear. And that when I could give those things to God in steps 4 through 12, and I no longer have to be angry, you're not disturbing me anymore, your behavior is not causing that emotional upheaval, and I love a good resentment. What's the payoff to a good resentment, isn't it? I don't have to take responsibility for my life. I can abdicate responsibility. I can eat a mastodon, blame you, and I don't have to take any responsibility for my life. I love that. Because you're doing these things that are making me mad, because I have a script in my head, selfish. I want what I want, self-seeking. I'll lie when the truth is better to try to manipulate the world into doing what I want, whether by hook or by crook. I suffer from the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction out of this world if only I managed well. So I will lie. I will manipulate. I will cheat. I will do what it takes to get you to do what you want. And in the aftermath of that, in the guilt and the shame and in the remorse of those things, I am going to think, hey, how about a pizza tonight? Without ever connecting it in my mind that there is cause and effect. There are people sitting in this room that may not be compulsive overeaters. Maybe they can diet down without a spiritual awakening, and maybe they can successfully stay out of the food because they're coming in here to work out other issues, and they like it, so they stay, and God bless you. I am a compulsive overeater. I have an illness that's fatal, progressive. And while I'm in here, my illness is at kung fu lessons. It's doing push-ups and pull-ups and road work. If I don't have a God that works in my life, I will eat again. So I have a changing God. I have a God that metamorphosizes over time. No matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. And as a human being, things are going to happen. I got divorced 1.5 years ago. I didn't want that. It happened. Okay. I have a 17-year-old. Doesn't like me anymore. Okay. I, like millions of Americans, I'm thinking, where is my SEP fund going? Where is all these various things are happening, but they're not happening to me. They're happening. And if I use the steps they will not draw me into the food. I have to have that awareness of a God in two. And whenever people come to me and they are having a problem with a step, it's my experience, it's never that step that they're struggling with. It's going backwards, and usually we end up back at one or two. That there is not that God that that person trusts. So why would they turn their will and their life in 4 through 12 over to the care and direction, that's the original language of the step, care and direction of God, that they don't like or trust, that doesn't trust them, that doesn't like them. And I could not do that. I had to recreate God. I had to recreate a higher power. I'm alive, and I've lost over 500 pounds from the very beginning when I got over 700 pounds. I'm walking on two legs. Yeah, I've got false hips and a false knee, and I got to have the other knee done, but I'm alive. I am a miracle of mental health. I am a miracle. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. What I did to my mind and body tested them to their limits. It says we are miracles of mental health. And physically, hardly any of us show dissipation. I invite you, if you're here and you're fighting the food, and you're hoping to hear something where you'll be good today, you didn't hear it from me because I can't give you dieting tips. I don't have them. If you're here and you're angry, or you're here and you're scared, or you're here and you're uncomfortable and convinced that if so-and-so would do this or not do that, that your life would be wonderful, I invite you to join Overeaters Anonymous. I invite you to walk the path of this miraculous way of life and this miraculous program. I invite you to trudge the happy road of destiny with all of us who are here. This is the most miraculous way of life. Now, I gave this illness decades of my life. I'm not giving it one more minute. And I don't have to if I work the steps in this book. I don't have to. There is no greater way of life. I wouldn't wish being a fat kid on anybody, but that was what got me here so that I could be the luncheon speaker at this OA birthday. I am honored, and just to close with our founder, co-founder, my left rear end, from the title of Roseanne's book, This Way of Life Will Affect a Succession of Compulsive Overeating, and as the disease does not just make us fat, it wreaks havoc on our life. The recovery, I invite you, if you don't test it, come and do it, test it. It will pick you up, and it will elevate you to heights you didn't even know were there. I invite you to join this way of life. It is truly beyond our wildest dreams. Thank you so much.
Forget anytime soon. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you for joining us for the meal. Thank you for joining us to hear Harlan. Well worthwhile. The sessions start in about 10 minutes. Please calmly, slowly, lovingly walk with your fellows out back into the area. We appreciate you being here, and we'll see you all at dinner. Thank you.